Welcome to the Morning Phillips series, co-sponsored with the Bush Foundation and the NUMAD Group, hosted at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Phillips series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It is an opportunity to have a conversation with good people doing good things creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a presentation, a dialogue, not a pitch, two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. And today we are pleased to have with a scientist, a teacher, a collaborator. The NUMAD Group would like to extend a special thanks to Wes Brown, South Dakota Public Broadcasting for sound and recording, Scott with Sumner Law for brewing coffee, Barefoot Dance Studio for some of the chairs you're sitting in, Kelly, Sunny, Courtney for setup, Chris for photography, the members of the Garage for allowing us to use your space, the Bush Foundation, and for everyone here joining us at 7 a.m. For further information about what goes on at the Garage, please follow us on Facebook, check out garagerapidcity.com, live tweet today at #morningphillip. And now with all that, please join me in welcoming Dr. Nigel Yock. Nigel, the director of Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory.
So my challenge is my voice. So I'm going to be calm and relaxed. The name is Lockyer, Matt.
Thank you. So.
And I have lots of lozenges. I have water. I have coffee. I have more lozenges. It'll be fine.
So I think there's a few things that people are interested in learning about today. Mm-hmm. Can we start with talking a little bit about Fermilab? And can we break down, since your arrival at Fermilab, what the focus has been there? And then the follow-up is, how does that connect with Sanford Underground Research Facility 50 miles away from here?
Okay, so Fermilab is a Department of Energy laboratory devoted to particle physics. So there's 17 national laboratories, of which we're one, and most of them focus on a multitude of things, 10 things, let's say, 10 areas of research: batteries, energy, computing, et cetera, et cetera. Fermilab just does particle physics. We do basic science. We do no classified work. It was started in 1968. We just celebrated our 50th year a couple years ago. And we're famous for discovering the top quark, the bottom quark, and the tau neutrino. So they're six quarks and six leptons. So we've discovered two quarks and one lepton. Not bad for a day's work, you know.
And if I can interrupt, you were heavily involved in discovering top quark.
Yeah, that's right. So I was on one of two experiments. So Fermilab, up until 2011, was the highest energy collider in the world, which means we collided protons and antiprotons to make particles and discover new things. And so that was our claim to fame. The world came to Fermilab to participate in that. It was two large experiments for a period of time. I led one of those experiments called CDF, Collider Detector at Fermilab, not very original. The other one was called D0, which is the location in the ring. That was A, B, C, D, so they were even less original. But there was about 1,500 scientists on each of those two experiments, so about 3,000 scientists total working at the lab. Today we have collaborations with, I'll say, 55 countries from around the world. Part of our strategy for the future is that we are a global laboratory. Even though we're a Department of Energy laboratory, we want to be an open laboratory to scientists from all around the world. That's a bit of a challenge. when you're inside the U.S. government umbrella, but so far we've been pretty successful at that. And we have scientists that do research at Fermilab that come from over 100 countries. So you come into the lab, you sense you're in, you hear different languages in the cafeteria, all that kind of thing. And why do we care about that? We want the best scientists in the world coming to help us do the research we want to do. So the connection to LEED, South Dakota, let's say, the Sanford Underground Research Facility, is that when I came to Fermilab, there was a desire for our field to decide what it was going to do next. You could argue the first 50 years were very successful. We can talk about that a little bit more. I mentioned the particle discoveries. But the Tevatron had been closed, turned off, and the scientific community had gone to Geneva, Switzerland, to the CERN facility. And that's where the highest energy collisions take place today. So, and there's a whole story behind that with regards to the U.S. tried to launch a large collider in Texas, which you may remember, which for various reasons, I would say most of which were reasonable, the government decided to cancel it. And interestingly, nowadays, China's trying to build it and Europe's trying to build it. So it's still a great idea because nobody pursued that. But anyways, that's what the rest of the world's looking at. So we had to decide what we were going to do for the next 50 years. It's a big laboratory. There's about 2,000 people there. It's a laboratory that builds things, so we don't all sit in offices, you know. We're in large construction space, building accelerators and so on. It's an accelerator lab. It was started as the National Accelerator Laboratory, NAL, and then it became the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, and now it's just Fermilab. But accelerator's in the name, and so accelerators are used for accelerating particles. And then either they run into another set of particles that we've accelerated, or they hit a stationary target. In the case of neutrinos, you accelerate particles, protons, and a proton is the nucleus of the hydrogen atom, and it strikes a carbon target. The target is can I borrow your pen there? No. Thought I was attacking him. It's okay. The target is about twice as long as his pencil, and it's about the same thickness, and it's carbon. So the proton strikes that. There's at the moment there's about 3/4 of a megawatt of power that goes into that. You make all these particles you probably never heard of, pions and all sorts of things. But they only live for a short period of time, and when they decay into neutrinos. I don't know if decay is something you understand, but decay means the particle transforms itself. You know, it's like parents transforming themselves into kids or something. We talk about daughters and sons and so on of the particles, usually daughters for some reason. And those neutrinos that come out just before the particle decays, we have a magnet that pulses very hard to squeeze the particles together. Charged particles respond to a magnetic field. They're bent in a magnetic field. You focus the charged particles, and then the neutrinos come out. And then you just point it in the direction you want to send it. So from Chicago, if you want to, and you're a neutrino, and you want to come to South Dakota, You dive into the ground 6 degrees from the horizontal. So South Dakota's down there in Chicago. And it goes through the Earth. And at the deepest part traveling through the Earth, it's about 30 miles under the surface. And when it arrives in I'll say Sanford Underground Research Facility, our experiment is going to be about a mile underground. It is a roughly 4850 level. And the experiment will be 70,000 tons of liquid argon. Argon is a tiny component of air. It comes from air. So it's kind of a harmless substance. But we cool it to a liquid. It's very cold. It's colder than your refrigerator. And your car weighs about a ton and a half, let's say. So 70,000 tons is a humongous amount of cryogenic fluid. In fact, it'll take about a year to fill up the first of four detectors. So the size of these things are, I'm used to meters, but let's see if I can convert meters to feet for Matt.
Thanks.
So maybe 200 feet long. They're 60 feet high, 60 feet across, and there's four of them. So if you've been into Washington, D.C., if you've been in a metro station in Washington, that's the size of one of the caverns. So, and then we fill it up with a cryogenic fluid, and you say, why are they so big? And the answer is because neutrinos, first of all, do you want to ask me a question, Matt, or you just want me to just keep talking? But
if you could wrap it up.
Okay. Okay. All right. I'll stop there.
No, we're at DC in a metro station.
Yeah.
And it's filled with argon. No, it's filled
it
with.
It is, it could be, yeah.
And why is it so large?
So I'm just going to say it's large because neutrinos are the weakest. Neutrinos have a few properties that are interesting. One is it's the weakest interacting particle that exists. So a proton interacts through the strong force. And a proton in your body will go a few millimeters at most at, you know, at a reasonable energy. An electron, because it's charged, and proton is charged too, but the electron is charged, it only goes a short distance. But a neutrino is not charged, it's neutral. And it only interacts through the weak interaction. So the nucleus is held together with the strong interaction, sometimes called the nuclear force, but we just call it the strong interaction. Charged particles interact through the electromagnetic interaction. And then there's the weak interaction, which was first described by Fermi. Fermi was the one who really wrote down an equation. Fermi was an amazing scientist. He was both an experimental scientist as well as a theoretical scientist. That's pretty unusual. I'm an experimental scientist. So he would write down the equation and he would say, I think this is how particles would interact. He named the neutrino. The neutrino is Italian and it means little neutron. So this was at a time when people really didn't know what was going on, and so they thought it was a neutron. And so anyways, he coined that name. There's a famous paper that was submitted to Nature magazine. Matt will bring this up in a minute, but okay. So to Nature magazine. And it was hypothesizing the existence of the neutrino for various reasons in physics. The paper was rejected. They said it was too far-reaching, was not believable. It was in fact true. But that just tells you, you shouldn't be discouraged when your paper's rejected from Nature. It's probably okay.
Well, along those lines too, there's been experiments happening and work happening in the mine here in South Dakota for years. Mm-hmm. And similarly, Ray Davis's work was dismissed for decades.
That's correct. So the Homestake mine is already famous in physics. It's famous around the world. So there was a, so let me finish a little bit with neutrinos. So first of all, they're the weakest interacting particle. There are more neutrinos than any other particle in the universe, except photons. Now, physicists call photons particles. You might not, but we do. So it's ubiquitous. By many, many factors of 10 over, say, protons or electrons. So the world is made out of this stuff, and then way up here there's neutrinos. So the question is, you know, if there's so many, they must be important. You know, that's the logic. Does that work for you, Matt? Yeah. So it's the weakest interacting, it's the most ubiquitous, and it has a lot of properties which we don't know. So we don't know its mass. So when I was a student, the neutrino was massless. It had zero mass. And I remember everybody saying to me, my fellow students saying, well, my thesis is looking for neutrinos that have mass. And I said, you're wasting your time. You know, neutrinos are massless. They don't have mass. Well, Ray Davis does this experiment where he is trying to detect neutrinos from the sun. So the number of neutrinos going through your body now, everybody kind of throws this number around, but it's in round numbers, it's close. The number going through my thumbnail per second is a trillion. There's a trillion neutrinos going through every square centimeter of my body and your body as you sit there, primarily from the sun. So a very large number. In your lifetime, the probability is maybe one will interact somewhere in your body and you'll never know. So if you did an experiment as a student and there was beams of protons, there was beams of electrons, there was beams of kaons, you know, you close the door, the lights go on, flashing, stay away, dangerous, you know, radiation. Neutrinos, you just stand in the beam, you know. I thought this was very convenient. Because you could just sit right next to your experiment, read the newspaper. And as far as I can tell, it was job security because nothing ever happened. They don't interact. They just go through the detector. You never see what happens. Anyway, so Ray Davis wanted to detect neutrinos from the sun. There's three types of neutrinos associated with the three leptons. So there were six quarks, six leptons, three neutrinos, three leptons. So there's an electron neutrino, there's a muon neutrino, and there's a tau neutrino. The tau neutrino, remember, was Fermilab's neutrino. We're okay with the other ones, too. The muon neutrino was discovered by the former director of Fermilab, Leon Lederman, who got a Nobel Prize for that. Now, why we didn't get one for the third neutrino, I don't know. But you can write to the Swedish Academy saying something's wrong here. So Ray wanted to build an experiment. He built something which I'm going to say is the size of this room. He installed it at the 4850 level where we're going to put our Dune experiment. And he took data each year, and when the neutrino interacted in the detector, it created a type of atom that he could count. One by one. He counted atoms one by one. He was a chemist. I forgive him for being a chemist. What I haven't told you is that he was my office mate. He was in the next office to me. So he was a real gentleman, let's say. So each year he would put one data point in his notebook, and then he would go to a conference and present his data and say, look, I've detected neutrinos from the sun. And my friend here from Princeton, John Bacall, who's another famous physicist, says, Ray, you've got three times too few neutrinos. You don't have enough. Because the standard solar model, as it was called, predicted a certain activity. It knew from the brightness of the sun and so on. Nuclear fusion was thought to be relatively well understood. They knew how many neutrinos were coming out of the sun. But he was getting far too few neutrinos. This went on for decades. He never published it. And people like myself used to say, what could you be doing wrong, Ray? There must be something wrong with your experiment. You know, you sure you know how to count? I mean, do you need my help? You know? So at some point, another experiment gets launched in Canada. It was called the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, SNOW. And that experiment used heavy water. So Canadian reactors make something called D2O rather than H2O, or use it. And so Canada has a lot of D2O, and so this was borrowed from the government to do an experiment. What was unique about it is that not only could you detect electron neutrinos from the sun, but you could detect the total flux of neutrinos, all three types of neutrinos. So what they found is that the number of electron neutrinos were down by a third, or down by a factor of three, matching Ray Davis's measurement. And they measured that the total flux was what was predicted by John Bacall. So the conclusion is that the electron neutrino somehow, which is what Ray can detect in his experiment, he couldn't detect the other two types, was changing, we say mixing, changing into the other type of neutrino on its journey from the sun. And so that was the answer. So Nobel Prize. Just like that.
And tied to 50 miles from here.
And it was done here. Yeah, it was done here at the Sanford Underground Research Facility. So if you go to the visitor center in Lee, they have, it's a beautiful visitor center. They have a ring that comes from the original detector of Ray Davis. And for those of you who like, you know, want to know more about this, there's a NOVA show on it, which is very good. It has John Bacall and Ray Davis in the show.
So, I even wrote the little neutron.
Very good.
Thanks. So is there pressure around the Nobel Prize?
Pressure?
Yeah.
What do you mean pressure? To get
your
one?
Your predecessor got one. We just talked about
one. Oh, yeah. You mean, why don't I have one? Is that what you're...
How long have you been at it?
A long time.
You started your career in university. You taught for...
No, I started my career in elementary school, and then I worked my way up to... I didn't start in...
So
I know you think I'm brilliant, Matt, but I did not start in university.
So how did you end up doing this work? What was, when you look back, elementary, high school, college, what was it that kind of put you on this path? Mentors, what was it?
Well, as I've told people, it was my grade 11 high school teacher who taught physics, and as I say, he was an engineer, but that's okay. He taught physics, and I found it fascinating. What I found fascinating was talking about atoms and nuclei and particles, things I'd never heard of before, which just was, you know, sort of mind-blowing when you're in high school, because you have other things you're doing in high school. And so I was a language major in high school. So I was taking five languages, and I thought, wow, this stuff's kind of cool. So in grade 12, in Canada you go to grade 13 too. You know, you waste a year, an extra year in high school. But in grade 12 and grade 13, I shifted to math, physics, chemistry, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that was an interesting shift. But nevertheless, I liked it, and I decided I would go to university and go in, you know, into science. And then my professor in Toronto at York University, you know, sort of took me under his wing a little bit. And by the time I was graduating, I'd worked a couple of summers in the Ontario government in Toronto. So I thought I was going to go and get an MBA and be a businessman, you know. He says, "You're not a businessman. You can't possibly be a businessman." I said, Why can't I be a businessman, you know? So he says, "You've got to go to graduate school. You've got to try it out. You're not interested in money." Okay. So that tells you a little something about being a scientist. You're not going to get rich. Late August, I decided to apply to graduate school to start in September. Thought, okay, let's try this out. So I did that, and then, you know, the rest is history. I just kept going.
The first part of your career, you spent a lot of time and seemed to be interested in the practical applications of science, of your work. Is that right?
No.
Okay. Does anybody have a question?
No, that was a bit later. So there's some truth to what you say, Matt. So so I went to, I was at Stanford working in their facility for 5 years, where I worked with two Nobel Prize winning physicists, Bert Richter, who just passed away last year, and Martin Pearl, who passed away a few years before that. Both did groundbreaking work, you know, it's fantastic people that I worked with. And so they were the formative years, I would say, for me. Then I went to the University of Pennsylvania as a professor, and I was there for 22 years. And you know, Penn is an Ivy League school. It's noted for its medical school. It's noted for the president went to the University of Pennsylvania, as you probably read about all the time in the paper, the Wharton School. So the university is basically a business medical school, and then there's a lowly physics department where, you know, the rest of us work. So just an aside comment here, if you go to Penn and there's a faculty meeting, there's 1,200 faculty in the medical school, there's 35 in physics, you know. So how are you ever going to influence the system? That was my conclusion. So I decided I should get involved in the medical school. And I had a number of students graduate with PhDs in working on PET scanners, positron emission tomography. So that is a particle physics-like detector. You inject a patient with something called FDG, fluorodeoxyglucose, which is a radioactive sugar. Your body thinks it's sugar for a while, and it goes to any location in your body that's using energy. If you're thinking, it goes to your brain. If you're, you know, doing something else, it goes there. But when it gets there, the body recognizes this is not quite what we ordered, and it just sits there. And then, because it's radioactive, it decays. It decays with a positron. So the positron is the anti-electron. It's antimatter now inside your body. And it travels maybe a millimeter, and it sees an electron immediately because it's surrounded by atoms. It's surrounded by normal matter. And it annihilates, which means the positron and the electron turn into two photons, each of which have the energy of the electrons and the positron. So it's a fixed energy. Momentum is conserved, they go back to back. So they come out, you detect two things like this. You can draw a line between them. And then another one comes out, and you draw a line. You can already figure out it's going to cross where it comes from. Now you do that in three dimensions. That's why it's called tomography. And you can reconstruct a tumor, for example. So it's used in detecting very small tumors in the body. So I had a number of students that worked on that. We introduced the idea of adding timing to these detectors to clean up the images and so on. So I did that for a number of years, just on the side, I would say. I was still, you know, particle physicist, but so that was good. And I still have, you know, students out there floating around doing good things.
So as you talk about some of the practical implications of the work that you have focused on at some point in your career, now you look at what you've been focused on these last years at Fermilab and what you just described here, that Stanford Underground Research Facilities partner in with you. Mm-hmm. What do you imagine results of the from this work?
Okay, so I have to give you some history of the field first so you can see how things work. But let me emphasize that basic science is basic science. You're doing science because you want to learn something. That's your goal. But it often has...
Can I interrupt you for a moment?
You did.
I did. So why do you find that interesting?
What's interesting?
Basic science.
Don't you find it interesting, Matt?
I mean, I find lots of things interesting, but definitely.
I think some of us are curious to where the universe came from. We're interested in where our galaxy came from. We're interested in where these particles came from. It's the whole question of, you know, you can sort of walk backwards in time and ask, you know, if you accept evolution, then you can talk about evolution. You can talk about the evolution of the solar system. You can talk about the evolution of our galaxy. You can then talk about the evolution of the universe. And physics, my type of physics, particle physics, goes all the way back to the beginning. So we're interested in T equals zero. So where are we now? I would say we're at about 10 to the minus 34 seconds after the Big Bang. So that's a very small number. So that's 10 to minus 1, 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 3. It's 10 times smaller each time. 10 to the minus 34 is the period in which the universe went through a so-called inflationary period, where it went through a period of rapid expansion. Now, what does that mean? Well, you go from the size of, say, a pea to the size of a grapefruit. So that period has imprints on the photons, the background photons that we measure, that will allow us to understand a little bit about how galaxies were formed. We can talk about it more, but so then later on, as you know, as the universe expands, it's very hot, as you might imagine, and it cools just because it's expanding. So this is space expanding now in three dimensions. And after this so-called inflationary period, the energy associated with that produces the particles that we now know exist today. And then those particles, there's always a particle and an antiparticle. They all find their partners, and they annihilate, and they make photons, except for about one in a billion. And what the matter that you see in the universe is those leftover particles. So we can count, roughly speaking, number of photons in the universe, number of protons in the universe, just based on number of stars and galaxies and light and so on. It's an estimate. But it looks like the ratio is one in a billion. So the question is, why didn't they perfectly annihilate? We think neutrinos have something to say about that. And so that's the interest in the neutrinos. It goes right back to the early universe. So that's one thing. The early structure of the universe depends on the mass of the neutrino, which is, we don't know the mass of the neutrino, we just know it's small. It's about a trillion times lighter than the top quark, the particle I'm, say most familiar with, top quark, bottom quark. That factor of a trillion is very hard to understand in physics. Why is the neutrino so light? Everything's kind of over here, and then you got this thing way over here. So in spite of that, because there's so many neutrinos, it impacts the formation of galaxies, all kinds of things. And you can do simulations where you show that the mass actually matters, even though it's about an electron volt or a tenth of an electron volt. So, you know, most people think of the electron as being a very light particle. It is the lightest particle we have going around the nucleus. There's lots of electrons. It's chemistry. The neutrino is about a million times lighter than the electron. So this creates a problem for physicists. So I think, what I find interesting is this connection between the smallest entities in the universe, which make up the atom, which make up the proton. The proton is a big, ugly particle. It's full of stuff. It's got quarks, it's got gluons, it's got virtual quarks, all kinds of stuff going on in there. It's not a fundamental particle, neither is the neutron. The electron is thought to be a fundamental particle. The quarks are thought to be fundamental. By fundamental, I mean has no observable size. You try and measure it, and it's smaller than your best resolution you can see. So we basically say they have no structure. Neutrino falls into that category of we think it has no structure, never observed it. So that smallest of entities in the universe was what got me interested in physics in the beginning in high school. But throughout my career, the connection, there was a very famous book written by Steven Weinberg, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, The First 3 Minutes. And The First 3 Minutes is a fantastic little book. You know, you can read it in one evening. But that was the first popular book I remember reading that described how the universe evolved at the very beginning, right after the Big Bang, how the particles came out, and at different temperatures you made different particles. At the highest temperature you make the most massive particles, and then less massive. And at some point the protons and the neutrons form a nucleus, and this is like a second or so after the Big Bang, and I thought, wow, this is all really interesting. So you can go out and you can measure the amount of hydrogen in the universe, the amount of deuterium, the amount of lithium, and it all fits the so-called Big Bang model. It all kind of hangs together, not perfectly, because we're always looking for some deviation, but hangs together pretty well. So you're now seeing that the smallest entities in the universe are connected to the largest, what are now the largest structure, because the universe has expanded. Particle physics also is interested in space-time. So what is space? What is it made out of? Is it a particle itself? Some of you have probably heard of string theory. String theory is a theory that tries to combine all the forces together, including gravity. It combines relativity and with quantum mechanics, and tries to explain where everything comes from. It hasn't manifested itself experimentally, but there was a huge effort for, I would say, at least two decades, maybe longer, in trying to see whether that was really describing nature, and it's kind of hanging out there right now, like stalled. They need input from experimental measurements to see whether it's true. Something called supersymmetry is required to explain string theory, or be part of string theory. And supersymmetry has not been observed. So, you know, in the 1930s, 1940s, when you first, Paul Dirac, very famous British physicist, predicted the existence of antimatter, then you started finding antimatter particles. And now we know we basically doubled the number of particles. You know, we had more particles and then we had antiparticles. Supersymmetry would double it again. But nothing's been observed, and so I would say a large number of physicists are just scratching their heads over why that's not there. We don't know. But the point is that, oh, thank you. The point is that the very small is connected to the very large. And I've sort of seen that throughout my career, which is now it's just accepted. So particle physicists, you know, Fermilab has an experiment in with many other collaborators from around the world in Antarctica, in Chile, Geneva, Switzerland, Canada, South Dakota, you know, all over the world, experiments all over the world. And that's the way it's done now. And so I think it's a fascinating field. You can be as inquisitive as you like. I was interviewed recently and somebody said, you know, what's your favorite question to ask? And I said, why anything? I mean, you can go back, and then why is there anything? Why is there even space? Forget the stuff in the space. So, you know, you can start to address those questions with some of the modern techniques that are being developed, technology that's being developed. So it's an exciting time in science.
Nigel, why anything, you keep going back, go back, go back.
Mm-hmm.
Where does religion play into that?
Oh, boy. All right, so I keep myself out of trouble by making the following statement. There's certain things you know, and there's certain things you don't know. What we do know is, you could argue, it's written in the textbooks, or they've written in papers, but you get back to a certain point in the early universe, and you don't know what happened. You don't know why it happened, you don't know where it came from, you don't know if somebody made it, you don't know if nobody made it. I mean, you just don't know. So I always, at least from my standpoint, I put religion in that slot. I say, well, it's reasonable for people to think what they want to think, and we don't know, we can't counter it. So, you know, that's more work needed, right? I mean, I think the beauty of physics, the symmetry of physics, all these kind of things, I think, argue for something, but I don't know what it argues for. So I just leave it at that. I leave it as kind of, that's up to you, what you want to do. But I don't think science contradicts religion, if that's what you're asking. Not at all.
If you were able to answer the why, or what's next, the, mm-hmm. that origin of the universe, I think you've referenced that in the last day, do you think we as a society are able to grasp that, to work with that? What happens then?
Are you asking about American society? Are you talking about European society?
You've created a global network.
Everybody thinks about science differently. Different countries have different views on science.
America, the United States specifically.
Okay, South Dakota especially.
Not South Dakota. We can go broader.
All right, Illinois. What do you want? What's your question?
If you were able to define or come up with what is the origin of the universe, those big questions?
Yeah.
As we get closer to those,
yeah.
What's the impact on society? And are we able to wrap our arms around that and that would change anything in our lives?
That's a good question. So I would say that at least during my lifetime, I don't expect that answer to be made available. I mean, we keep probing, we keep pushing, but it just seems a little too far away for me to think we could understand that. One of the questions we talked about yesterday was, are there more than one universe? So, you know, we might be able to take physics back to what I would call T equals zero, which would be, you know, and the general thinking is that's when time started. And it's very hard for us to understand what it means that there was no time. What do you mean there's no time? Well, obviously there's something before that. But time is a very interesting variable in physics. It's a very interesting quantity that most physicists think it's something that was created at the beginning of the universe. And just as space expanded, time began. And so the T equals zero is the true creation point. But that doesn't say anything about whether there was something before or whether there's other things going on in parallel. We don't know. So, you know, you can just keep going on all these questions. And so you say, well, I'm not going to solve that this week. So let's get back to neutrinos. You know, so, but that's what scientists do. They explore ideas that interest them. But ultimately, you know, the day-to-day work, I don't want to say you have a wrench in your hand and you're turning a nut, but it's pretty close to that. You build structures, you build very sophisticated experiments. You know, we're lucky in the United States that we have, you know, what is the definition of technology to a physicist? It means that I can open up a catalog and order something. I don't have to make it. You know, when I visited the Soviet Union in the 1990s and I would see Soviet scientists making oscilloscopes. We need an oscilloscope, so we're going to make one. A year later, they've got an oscilloscope. And that's when I realized, what is technology? Well, I guess I just look it up and I order it. And nowadays, it comes, you know, within a week and you've got yourself an oscilloscope. So
if you have Prime. 2 days.
Yeah, 2 days. Yeah, I was trying to avoid giving a commercial for Amazon, but okay. So the point is that you build on what you've already established. So you build on very sophisticated electronics and so on and so forth, and you use that to make measurements that you never made yesterday because you're going to add something new to it. You got to, in order to advance science, you have to advance technology. So, you know, a simple example would be, I have a microscope. I can see certain size, but I want to see something smaller. I need a better microscope. Particle accelerators are basically microscopes. They allow you to look at small things. So we're always trying to look at smaller and smaller and understand how they work. So we look for the properties of the smallest entities. And to do that, for example, with the Dune experiment, we are developing electronics which, say developed, and will develop more so, microelectronics that sit in the cryogenic fluid. So this is very challenging, because when you design a chip or something like that, there's software you get from some company and you spend a year with the circuits and everything, and then finally it's ready to go and you ship it back to the company and hopefully you get a chip back that works. And in our case, we would find that designing chips in a cold liquid, they would come back and they wouldn't work. They weren't even close to what we had simulated. So there's the gap in the technology. The technology was not advanced enough to simulate, you know, the performance of a, say, a transistor in a cold liquid. So why is that interesting? Well, a very new and expanding field that's taking place in physics now is quantum information science. And that is, there's an initiative, legislation that was passed and signed by the president Christmas Eve. So when you were reading all that crazy stuff going on at Christmas, the president actually signed something that was very interesting to physicists. That was the one thing he did Christmas Eve, was sign that legislation. And it was creating a whole initiative across the US government to advance quantum information science, which translates into your language perhaps as quantum computing. So this is a type of computing that is dramatically different from ones and zeros. It's taking advantage of the fact that in a quantum mechanical world, you can store a lot more information in what are called entangled states. Which is, if you think about an atom, let me give you an example. So you've got an electron in an atom, and you say, where is it? Well, I don't know where it is exactly. There's a probability of it being here or here or here. So there's a undetermined, indeterministic component to nature. You also don't know which energy level it is. So if you remember the Bohr model of the atom, there's the first level, the second level, the third level. They're all quantized. And you think of the electron could be in this energy level, and this energy level, and this energy level. In quantum mechanics, it's in all energy levels at the same time. It's in what we call linear combination of those. And there's a probability that it's in the ground state, it's in the first excited state, it's in the second excited state. But when you're not touching it, when you're not looking at it, it's in a linear combination of all of those. So now you realize that, wow, there's a lot of information stored there that maybe I could use in some fashion. And that's what quantum computing tries to do. It's a rather large leap of trying to manipulate nature. You know, I mentioned antiparticles in your body. That's manipulating nature, you know, using it to our advantage. If we want to go back to the Bronze Age, you know, that was a crude version of, you know, you find a rock, you heat it up, you melt it, you make some other material that's useful to you. Well, now we're just doing this at a very, very tiny level. And so, you know, some people have visions of quantum computers on cell towers and autonomous vehicles. So quantum computers are thought to be really good at optimization problems. So imagine having 10,000 trucks in the region and none of them have drivers and you want to optimize where they all go. They're just talking to the cell tower anyways. So we can take advantage of that by putting the quantum computer on that cell tower and they could control everything. You're not going to put the world's fastest computer on a cell tower because it's as big as this room, you know. They're huge, huge amount of power. So you want small, very powerful computing. So that's quantum computing. That's what the president views as something that he wants this administration to push forward. So I thought that was really a bold step. And Fermilab is, you know, all over this. You know, this is particle physics in some sense.
Nigel, when you think of, so we have about 10 minutes left, and about 10 questions.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of what the most important...
Faster.
It was just a hint. When you think of the most important science happening outside of Fermilab or the things that you're associated with, what is it?
Most exciting?
Mm-hmm. To you.
The problem, man, is as you get a little older, you get interested in everything. You know, it's probably you know. And so I wouldn't pick on anything in particular, but one of my favorite, I better say neutrinos are my favorite.
That you're not not associated with.
Oh, not associated with. I'm interested in, observation of the earliest, the first suns, first stars in the universe, which were made out of hydrogen, nothing else. So as I explained to you, you know, when a star finishes burning, it collapses, it can make a neutron star, it can make a black hole, but that explosion, that supernova, is the origin of the heavy elements. So the very first few stars in the universe were just stars made out of hydrogen. And it turns out they're humongous things. So the, Webb telescope that's about to go live, should they ever finish it, will observe, hopefully, these very early suns. And then we'll have a path of understanding how stars evolve through the universe. My favorite piece of information for our own solar system, since you have heavy elements in your body, and if you didn't, you wouldn't exist, the gold in your ring, all that kind of stuff, you need it to live. And that came from a supernova explosion about 5 million years before our sun started shining. That is not a long time for a star that's 5 billion years old. 5 million is nothing. So there was a supernova in our region at the time that created elements that then helped form our solar system that then make us. So we heard last night we're made out of stars. Absolutely true. It's just a fact. We don't have to laugh about it anymore. We know that.
A question from one of the people here. Cosmic rays, what are they, where they come from, and where do they go? Thank you.
So cosmic rays are just particles that come down from our galaxy, for example, and they could come from an explosion of a star. They can come from particles being sucked into a black hole, and they're accelerated in some fashion. So they strike our atmosphere. They create a shower of particles, and they rain down on us. And they make neutrinos. We can look at the neutrinos from that. But you have cosmic rays going through you all the time. There's a lot of cosmic rays. I would guess you've got, a couple going through you per second. And they just go right through you. And they ionize in your body. They cause damage. There was a time when people thought that the mutations in your DNA were primarily due to cosmic rays. Mm-hmm. Now we realize that's just a small component. Most of it, it's self-mutations in poor copying.
You mentioned early on that what you're leading is an international collaboration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How important is that it's an international network of countries that mm-hmm. have come together for one purpose?
Right, so DUNE, Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, is a collaboration of 31 countries, over 1,000 scientists from all over the world. Madagascar, we have a scientist from Madagascar, very exciting. It's important because what I said earlier, you want the people, the best people in certain areas. So some of the technology we're using, for example, the liquid argon technology was first developed by the Italians. So you would like Italians involved because they have the longest history. And I can give you a story about everyone else that gets involved. But it does two things. It brings in the expertise from around the world, but it also, they want to bring their stuff. You know, so if you're building a house and you want to make a fireplace, you say, I don't actually know how to make a fireplace. You call up your friend that knows how to make a fireplace and say, could you come and make a fireplace for me? That's how particle physics works. You call up your friends, could you bring this? Could you bring the electronics? Could you bring the detector? Could you do this? And then that's how you assemble something that's much fancier, much better, much, you know, much everything beyond what you could do yourself. And so that's the way basic science works.
What's the best piece of advice that you've received?
Piece of what?
Advice.
Advice. I thought you said ice. Best piece of advice.
That you've received.
Oh, you mean as a young scientist or whatever? Work your off.
What's the best piece of advice you've given?
Same thing.
Yeah. Who's your favorite scientist or philosopher?
My favorite scientist is Ernest Rutherford. I should say Fermi, I know, but Fermi's up there, but I like Rutherford. He was a tremendous scientist. He discovered the proton, you know. He is sort of the beginning of particle physics. I used to name my computer after scientists, and I always named it after Rutherford.
If you didn't do this work, what would you do?
I think I'd be a famous athlete or actor or something like that.
Is there a sport or a type of acting that you would like to have a role in?
I'd like to play a famous scientist in an exciting movie. You know, I don't know. I like all sports.
So, 100 some odd people here. What do you hope people take away from this?
Well, I hope they take away that you're going to be sitting in the middle of where something unique is happening in the United States and in the world for the neutrino experiment. It's going to take a number of years to build and start, but it will be the epicenter of something important in science. It'll bring people from all around the world to this region. Hopefully it carries on the great tradition of Ray Davis that he started. And, this was a vision I think Governor Rounds had, which is coming to fruition. And he wanted to make South Dakota a place where young people would want to stay and be able to, interact with the rest of the world. And if they want to go somewhere else, that's great. If they want to stay here, that's great. But at least they would be living in a very dynamic place. And I think technology nowadays and science nowadays will continue to be a huge part of our lives, both from economic standpoint and from impacting our daily lives to impact on medicine and so on. It's great that it's going to happen here. So you should pay attention to it.
Nigel, thank you for flying in yesterday and spending the evening and today with us. Really appreciate your words and really enjoyed it.